Due to the recusal of Judge Ryan in this case, today we're joined by Senior Judge Royce Lambreth from the District Court for the District of Columbia, and we welcome Judge Lambreth back. He has been helping us out quite a bit while we were down a judge for the past, most of this last term. Today we have United States versus Howell. Are the parties ready? Okay. We'll hear from the appellant first. You may proceed.
Chief Judge Erdman, judges, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Drew Austria, and I represent the accused, Staff Sergeant Stephen P. Howell, United States Marine Corps. Chief Judge Erdman, with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, the military judge properly awarded Staff Sergeant Howell confinement credit pursuant to Article 13. The government disagreed and petitioned the lower court, but the lower court did not have jurisdiction to entertain the government's petition. As this court recently held in United States v. Arness, a petition must be tied to the court's existing jurisdiction. In this case, Article 66 is not an avenue for the government to petition under the All Writs Act for the following reasons. First, government appeals are heavily disfavored, as recognized in the Supreme Court's case, United States Will. Additionally, Article 66 does not provide the government with direct appeal rights. It should not be allowed to circumvent the statutory scheme of the UCMJ. Third, the military judge's decision to award confinement credit does not affect the findings and the sentence in this case. Now, the government argues that its ability to bring petitions in Article III courts should allow it to do the same in the military justice system. But the government's ability to petition in Article III courts is greater due to the broad language of 18 U.S.C. 3731 and 18 U.S.C. 3742. If we look at 18 U.S.C. 3731, it provides that the government has interlocutory appeal rights, but it also contains a catch-all provision that's not available in Article 62. It states, the provisions of this section shall be liberally construed to effectuate its purposes. Now, if we look at 18 U.S.C. 3742, this also provides the government a direct appeal right. In limited circumstances, the government, on direct appeal, can appeal the sentence. Now, here, both of these types of provisions are noticeably absent from Article 62 and Article 66. Therefore, due to the fact that a petition must be tied to the existing jurisdiction, the government's ability to appeal in Article 3 courts, a petition is much broader than here in Article 1. As we already know that Article 1 courts act on behalf of the statute enacted by Congress, and here there's a limited purpose for jurisdiction. The government can't circumvent the statutory scheme by bringing a petition under the All Writs Act just because they can do so in Article 3 courts.
Well, what's the government supposed to do in a confinement credit case?
Well, in a confinement credit case, Your Honor, the government can't appeal or bring a petition, and Congress specifically delineated their rights to appeal. So if they can't appeal, since Congress says they can't, they shouldn't be able to bring a petition in this case.
Well, haven't we said in other cases that in cases where basically everything else is foreclosed, the government has the option for a writ appeal?
Well, Your Honor, even if they can't bring a writ appeal or a petition or a direct appeal, the government has other options. They can ask Congress to provide it additional appeal rights on one hand, and second...
In the context of a particular case, if the government's foreclosed from doing anything, you can go to Congress and spend 3 years, but what's government to do in the meantime?
Judge Stuckey, if the Congress hasn't provided the right to appeal, then the government may not.
Well, that's, of course, the question. That's why we're here.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. But if it hasn't been provided for by Congress, the government doesn't get to appeal every single decision. And without that right by Congress, that affirmative right, the government can't bring a petition or to circumvent the statutory scheme. We're not playing in an Article III world. We're playing in an Article I world, where there are specific jurisdictional requirements that have to...
Well, there are specific jurisdictional requirements in three as well. All federal courts, other than the Supreme Court, are creatures of statute, and all of them are limited by statute.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. But here, when we take into account the Article I courts, they don't have the same type of inherent powers that are given to them in Article III settings. And so that's where we're asking that this court exercise its limited jurisdiction and that...
Wait a minute. We don't have any power, but let's exercise what little puny power we have so you win. Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. We're not...
I'm sorry. I'm being facetious. Go ahead.
No, Your Honor, we're not diminishing the jurisdiction of this court. However, Congress has specifically limited the jurisdiction of this court, given that it's an Article I court, not an Article III. And so all we're asking is that this court look at its jurisdiction and...
It didn't specifically limit our power in this particular instance. And I think Judge Stuckey's point is, why shouldn't we look to the All Writs Act?
Could you repeat that one more time, Your Honor?
You were saying that Congress specifically limited us in terms of we're an Article I court, but it didn't specifically limit us in terms of this particular jurisdiction by the CCA.
Well, Your Honor, we would respectfully disagree. If we look at Article 66 and we look at the jurisdiction of the lower courts, we see that the lower courts recognize that Congress recognized that the CCAs shouldn't be putting the accused in a situation worse off than before. If the government's allowed to petition using Article 66, it's using their substantial right under 66C review to the accused's detriment. And I don't think that's what Congress intended when they enacted 66. And
why does it follow that Congress's enactment of 66 was in any way intended by Congress to limit what could be done under the All Writs Act?
Well, if we look at what the 66's legislative history, as well as the statute itself and the statutory scheme, we see that there's certain provisions that are set up for the government and certain provisions set up for the accused. And so looking at Articles 61, 62, and 66, we have to look at the entire statutory scheme in which Congress enacted the UCMJ. And it was very specific about the government's right to appeal under 62. And so we see that they gave the government the right for interlocutory appeals in 1983 so that they could go and get decisions on certain matters. But they didn't give them a blank check to appeal every single decision of a military judge.
So would you concede that Article 13 authority in the hands of a rogue military judge could be quite a powerful weapon?
I wouldn't say that it's a weapon, Your Honor. Specifically, that we're looking at Article 13, we're looking at making sure that the government's not punishing an accused pre-trial.
Okay, but that's not quite the question. Let's say, for the sake of argument, you've got a rogue military judge. He or she exercises Article 13 authority. No one can have any ability to put a check on that military judge's ability?
Well, Your Honor, there are two places where we can have to check that authority. First is Congress, because Congress could...
But that's prospectively. We're talking about in this case.
Well, Your Honor, they could also have the service JAG also remove the military judge at the end of the proceedings if the government was worried about a recurrence.
Okay, but that's prospective as well.
Yes, Your Honor. But here, there is no action for the government if the rogue judge, and we concede that. But that's not a right that the Congress has given to the government to appeal on sentence. And so... We would argue that's permissible given that they don't have a right to appeal.
Okay. Would you address the other issues?
Yes, Your
Honor. Article 13 issue.
Yes, Your Honor. Regarding the merits of the government's petition, the military judge did not usurp his authority in this case. He correctly recognized, as this court did in Keyes, that Article 75A...
We have held that Article 13 is limited to... situations in which there was an intent to punish and situations in which the restrictions imposed were greater than necessary to ensure that the accused shows up for trial. The judge specifically found there was no intent to punish, and there's no question of appearance for trial here. Therefore, what basis is there for any Article 13 credit?
Well, Your Honor, we disagree with...
It sounds like the judge is going to penumbras and emanations to dig up Article 13 credit.
Well, Your Honor, we would disagree with that assessment. So first, we would like to note that there doesn't need to be punitive intent. As this court held in Fisher, punitive effect is also a way to get around the punitive intent.
I don't think Fisher stands for that proposition, but go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, we also believe that there is punitive intent. In this case,
it's found otherwise.
Well, Well, Your Honor, the government...
Are you now asserting for the first time at this level there's punitive intent when it was found below there wasn't?
Well, Your Honor, we've raised it in the briefs and below that there was punitive intent, primarily due to the fact that the government concedes that the only reason why it's paying Staff Sergeant Howe as an E-1 is because it's continuing to execute the sentence from his first court-martial.
Well, now, wait a minute. The government scurries around trying to find out, it appears in good faith, what, if anything, they pay this guy. So they go to the sources of law governing military pay. Number one, DFAS. And number two, ultimately, the Federal Circuit and the Court of Federal Claims, which are vested with statutory jurisdiction over pay claims. So how is that either punitive or in bad faith?
Well, Your Honor, the government had a choice when they decided to pay Staff Sergeant.
The government what?
They had a choice between complying with the lower court's order to set aside the findings in the sentence and to allow him to get his presumption of innocence, or to comply with what they believed was the correct fiscal law. And so making that choice, they said, no, we're going to violate Staff Sergeant Howe's constitutional rights and instead comply with the fiscal case law that they thought was applicable. But it's not applicable in this instance, because if we look at Dock and Combs, we recognize that those cases are inapplicable to Staff Sergeant Howe's situation. The defendants in Dock and Combs were either still confined, they had convictions still left on the table, or they were beyond their EOS. Staff Sergeant Howe, on the other hand, has been released from confinement. He's brought back to a full-duty status, and he's performed the duties of an E6. These cases that the government relies on do not match the situation that Staff Sergeant Howe is. And so he's forced to come out here and create a situation in which he can find some meaningful for relief from the situation he's facing at hand. That's why he brings the Article 13 claim. And so here we still have punitive intent. But even without punitive intent, we have punitive effect. And we look at the factors that were potentially laid out by the Supreme Court in the Caitlin Mendoza case, and we look at the only reason, the only underlying rationale as to why they're paying him as an E-1 is the fact that he received an improper conviction at his first trial. And so if we look at it in that light, in that lens...
No, they're paying him as an E-1 because the relevant authority said you can only pay him as an E-1.
Well, they're paying...
I mean, I suppose you can challenge the constitutionality of the statutes governing pay, but I don't think that's in front of us.
But those... Well, Your Honor, the government can't hide behind the fiscal case law in Article 75. If we look at Article 75, it only addresses what was taken from the accused as a result of his first court-martial. It does not address the period from the time the convictions were set aside going forward. And so... This case law that the government relies on, this does not comply with what we think about when happens when there's a set-aside. Under Von Bergen...
Who has jurisdiction over these questions?
Over the pay questions, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Well, Your Honor, the Federal Courts of Claims and the Federal Circuit would have jurisdiction over the question of pay. But whether or not withholding of the pay, that's a specific question that this court can answer under its Article 13 powers. And
well, wait, you know, this is very interesting. Because you started out by telling us how circumscribed our jurisdiction is under Article 1. And now you're telling us that even though statutory jurisdiction over these questions resides elsewhere, we can somehow slide into it. I mean, it's one thing to grant confinement credit. You know, the judge did not purport to say he had to be paid anything. The judge just gave him confinement credit. The judge didn't go beyond his jurisdiction to get in the pay question. The judge gave him confinement credit. The rest of this is something else. The rest of this follows on the confinement credit.
Well, Judge Stuckey, those are two separate questions, and the Article 13 question was a proper question for the military judge to answer and for this court to answer.
Right, but my question, I'm asking you to address now the pay issue, and I think you said the jurisdiction over those questions resides elsewhere.
Yes.
So aren't the authorities in the military, in the Department of the Navy, then required to follow the precedents and directions of those courts and those entities charged with jurisdiction over these questions?
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that the government has a greater interest in protecting the constitutional rights of the accused versus the fiscal law that they are cited for.
Okay, so that constitution over money.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So we would argue, though, even though that the government may argue that there's no punitive intent, we see that in their actions. They were actually arbitrary and purposeless. If we look at the 39SA testimony of Ms. Tanner, she testified that both Staff Sergeant Hutchins as well as several other defendants had received full pay while they awaited the completion of their rehearing. These defendants...
Counselor, can I get you back to jurisdiction for a moment? How do you distinguish Suzuki from this case?
For the Article 13 credit, Your
right.
Honor? At this point, I'm not up to speed on Suzuki, so... Okay.
Well, in that case, didn't we hold that the CCA had jurisdiction when a convening authority challenged a military judge's award of confinement credit?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that was correct. And
so why, if a convening authority is challenging the award of confinement credit, and we found jurisdiction there, why would we not find jurisdiction here?
Well, Your Honor, that case, Suzuki, was decided in 1983, and there's other cases here, notably Clinton v. Goldsmith and our later decisions in this court's decision of United States v. Arnest. Those cases, Suzuki wasn't dealing with the situation of ex-writs at that time. And here we see that the court's jurisdiction is narrowing with regards to administrative-type matters. So that would be one way to distinguish Suzuki from the instance that we have here. But I'd like to come back and say that, you know, we're dealing with an administrative credit. And so for questions of jurisdiction, you know, this doesn't affect the findings and the sentence. The credit that's awarded by the military judge is administrative, as we've recognized in this court's holdings in Adcock and in Stringer. And so that's important because what's ultimately happening here is that the government's challenging something that doesn't affect the findings or the sentence, which is required.
But doesn't the action here by the CCA fall in the context of the CCA ordering a rehearing? And doesn't a CCA retain jurisdiction over a case when it's ordered a rehearing? So why is that not a jurisdictional hook in this case?
Well, here, Your Honor, even though that the CCA would order the rehearing, what's actually being adjudicated is whether or not the CA will actually list the confinement credit in the CA's action. And so that's an administrative item for the brig to know how much time to keep Staff Sergeant Howland. Your Honor, I see that my time expired. May I finish answering the question?
Yes, you can.
It's an administrative requirement. So we're not affecting the sentence. Staff Sergeant Howell still receives 9 years. The credit that's being applied and being listed in the CA's action is to let the brig know how long he should stay in the brig. This doesn't affect the findings. There was no post-trial 39A. So here we have an action that the government's trying to appeal that doesn't even affect the findings in the sentence. And this case, this court should dismiss on jurisdictional grounds on that alone. If there are no further questions, thank you.
You can continue on rebuttal.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Robert Miller, and along with Colonel Mark Jamison, I represent the United States. The military judge exceeded his discretionary power here in two main ways. First, he found that as a matter of law, appellant was entitled to E6 pay pending rehearing, contrary to the binding decision of the Court of Federal Claims in Combs. And second, he found an Article 13 violation absent any punitive intent based solely on DFAS's good faith pay entitlement determination.
Well, let's talk about jurisdiction first. What are the basis for the All Writs Act jurisdiction?
Your Honor, appellant is arguing that the government can't ever use the All Writs Act unless there's a direct nexus to Article 62. But Article 62 sets forth grounds for a direct interlocutory appeal by the government, so it's a mechanical statute. Article 62 hinges on the lower court's jurisdiction under Article 66, which is the lower court's jurisdictional statute, just as Article 67 is this court's jurisdictional statute.
You're not relying on Article 62. You're not relying on Article 62
no,
here.
Okay,
so what is the basis for your argument?
Your Honor, the United States argues that Suzuki, along with Ruppel, to the extent Judge Efron spoke for this issue, stand for the proposition that when the government, when the United States or the convening authority seeks to challenge a military judge's Article 13 ruling and award of confinement credit, the only way to do that is through the All Writs Act tied to the lower court's jurisdiction under Article 66. And the way that there is a nexus there is because the convening authority is required per Suzuki and RCM 1107F4F to apply that sentencing credit when he's approving the findings and sentence before it's forwarded to the Court of Criminal Appeals.
What do we do with the language in Adcock?
Well, in Adcock and Williams, this court did say that the sentencing credit doesn't affect the findings and sentence. Therefore, we can add the sentencing credit in our decretal paragraph. But neither of those cases concerned extraordinary writ jurisdiction. Rather, this court was looking at the fact that it didn't have to overturn the findings and sentence in order to affect additional sentencing credit. So it's a different context. But prospectively.
But doesn't that context include an administrative action on the judicially imposed sentence?
Yes, Your Honor. It is administrative in that context of ordering additional sentencing credit, which is why this court was able to order it in its decretal paragraph without having to overturn the findings and sentence below. But because the convening authority is required to award the sentencing credit or affect the sentencing credit in his approval action, then going forward, there's a direct nexus to the lower court's jurisdiction.
It becomes part of the approved sentence.
As approved by the convening authority. Now, that's the key. And if appellant's argument is correct and sentencing credit never impacts the findings and sentence as approved by the convening authority, well, then we're at a loss for how a military judge's ruling, whether for or against the United States, could ever be reviewed by any court because the lower court's jurisdiction is limited to the findings and sentences approved by the convening authority. This court's jurisdiction is limited to the findings and sentences approved by the convening authority and as affirmed by the lower court. And so it can't be that a military judge's rulings are subject to appellate review in every context except Article 13.
Now, should Goldsmith serve as a cautionary tale for this court, however, in regard to looking at how the All Writs Act should apply here?
Absolutely. This court needs, in this case, to reconcile its earlier holdings in Suzuki and Dettinger, Curtin, and Ruppel with the current case law, which very clearly says that in order to find writ jurisdiction, there has to be a potential to directly affect the findings and sentence. And that simply wasn't part of the case law at the time of Suzuki. But I think in this case, it's a much easier path to get there than in the cases like Goldsmith and CCR where you had these third parties, and it was hard to meet the burden of showing direct effect on the findings and sentence. Not so here because this is sentencing credit. It goes directly to the sentence that the convening authority may approve and pass on to the lower court. If I may, I'd like to turn to the merits issues. In Allen, this court recognized that the Court of Federal Claims exercises exclusive jurisdiction over military pay entitlement under the Tucker Act. In Dock and Combs, the Court of Federal Claims, interpreting Article 75A, said that in this singular circumstance where the findings and sentence are set aside but a rehearing is authorized and ordered on the original charges, the executed part of the first sentence that's included in the sentence upon rehearing remains in effect through the pendency of the...
But aren't those cases distinguishable in terms of confinement of the accused or not having duties that were commensurate with their pay grade?
Yes, Your Honor. So Dock and Keyes are distinguishable because in those two cases, Dock and Keyes remained in confinement. Combs is distinguishable because although he was brought back to a full-duty status, he was working in an E-1 billet, unlike appellant here.
But, so why should we be looking at those cases if they're distinguishable on their facts?
Well, the importance in Combs is that this court looked exclusively at punitive intent. Didn't cite Article 75A, never considered pay entitlement, because Combs in that case was moving for sentencing credit first and foremost. Not so here, where Staff Sergeant Howell was initially looking for back pay. So he was asking the military judge to order back pay, And the military judge said, I don't have the authority to do that, and he turned it into an Article 13 issue.
So you're focusing on punitive intent.
Yes, Your Honor.
In your view, punitive effect doesn't matter?
No, Your Honor. I think this court suggested in Fisher that there's a possibility that a regulation that clearly conflicted with Title 37 U.S.C. Section 204A, which entitles all service members to be paid at their assigned rank, could potentially be punitive in effect. But that was an argument that was pushed by Fisher in that case. And before the court even got there, it said that there's no punitive intent in that case. And that was the thrust of its holding. It said even if we were to adopt a punitive effect test, looking at the Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez factors, even then we wouldn't find an Article 13 violation here. And it's significant that this court has only cited Fisher three times since it was decided in the 2 years following, whereas in every Article 13 case, in almost every Article 13 case, this court cites King, which is exactly what Judge Stuckey referred to, punitive intent, or the potential that there's no legitimate government objective for the government action.
So your position is that Fisher's dictum?
That aspect of Fisher, but that wasn't the holding in Fisher. And so,
no, but the allusion to intent, the allusion to effect,
yes, Your Honor.
And is dicta.
That's absolutely right,
okay.
Your Honor. And it's significant also, not only did this case only cite it three times, but this is the first time that Court of Criminal Appeals has ever found Article 13 on the grounds of punitive effect. It's the first time a lower court has ever found that good faith efforts to follow the law could potentially violate Article 13. Only the Navy Court has ever even applied the Kennedy factors, and that was in Castillo, it was a self-incrimination Fifth Amendment issue. So
regardless whether or not it's dicta or not, in this case, would you consider this to be punitive in effect?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
The reason that the lower court, in its analysis, and the military judge didn't even run the punitive effects analysis, so the lower court did this for the first time, and the way that they were able to apply those seven factors in order to find punitive effect was by focusing on the reduction itself, for the most part, as punishment, and ignoring that what we're talking about is a continued pay status pursuant to Court of Federal Claims and DFAS policy. And so...
isn't it possible that the Court of Federal Claims and the DFAS policy is punitive in effect? I mean, that's what we're looking at here. Obviously, the government is pointing to, well, we have to do it because this is what the rule says. And isn't it possible that the effect of that rule is punitive?
It's possible, but not in this case.
But it's not here? The fact that he got paid at an E-1 rate while he was at E-6 and was... had E6 responsibility?
Your Honor, the reason that this it wouldn't be punitive here is because he was getting paid at the pay grade assigned pursuant to 37 U.S.C. 204A. And to the extent that the second sentence, the rehearing, there was a difference with the first hearing, he would have a claim in the Court of Federal Claims to get all that back pay back. But there's no punitive effect here because he was earning what he was entitled to at his assigned pay grade.
But just in terms of common sense, okay, he'd been tried and convicted, but that had all been set aside. Conviction set aside, sentence set aside. He's an E6. He's performing E6 duties and responsibilities. But Uncle Sam is saying, despite all that, we're only going to pay you as an E1. Why is that not punitive, just in terms of common sense? Regardless of you're saying DFAS and so forth, and your argument is well taken. But why is that not punitive?
Your Honor, it's not punitive in the military context because our pay, and I don't want to go back to what I was just saying, our pay is defined by statute, and it doesn't matter what you're doing. It's not a quid pro quo for services rendered. So my friend here cannot go to the Court of Federal Claims tomorrow and say, I did a better job than Lieutenant Miller, I need a raise. That may be a more equitable system, but he's unable to do that because we're both service members. And same thing here. To the extent that there's a due process issue where it's unfair, fundamentally unfair, on a constitutional level, Staff Sergeant Howell has the ability to go to the Court of Federal Claims and argue that those prior cases, Combs, Dock, those violated the Constitution. But this isn't the venue for that, because this court is limited to issues of military justice, and pay entitlement is exclusively the province of the Court of Federal Claims, as this court held in Allen.
Now, in your brief, you refer to the fact that, in your view, Chevron deference should be granted. But isn't Chevron deference really in those instances where Congress explicitly leaves a gap for government agencies to fill? And that wasn't the situation here, was it?
No, that's not the situation here. And so the United States, our position doesn't rely on Chevron deference. But to the extent that this court finds that the statute in question, Article 75, subsection A, is inherently ambiguous, and that we need to look to the agency interpretation, the agency that's designated by Congress via the Secretary of Defense for statutory and regulatory compliance in this area, then we have to give some deference to DFAS, because this is how they're interpreting the statute. But the United States position doesn't rely on Chevron deference. And the United States is well aware that this would be perhaps a first where this court has given agency deference to DFAS. Your Honor, I think there's good reason to resist going back to the punitive effects test. There's good reason to resist applying the punitive effects test or expanding it in this context. In Article 13, where we're dealing with pay, because we've got numerous government actors, both military and civilian, involved across the country in every pay question. And when we're talking pretrial confinement,
But you're talking about all the practical reasons why it's happening, and we're looking at the effect on this individual.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's, you know, I agree with Judge Olson that in looking at this from a common sense perspective, this is a punitive effect. The conviction has been taken away. He wears the rank of an E6, he has E6 duties, and he's being paid as an E1. Now that appears to be, or to have a punitive effect. It may not be intentional, but to him, it is.
Your Honor, it couldn't be the United States or the government authority, his command, was required to do all those things in Combs that this court found to be punitive, to violate Article 13 in order to avoid an Article 13 violation. In other words, reducing him visibly in rank to E1, taking away his E6 work and forcing him to work in an E6, E1 billet. It couldn't be that doing all those things is the only thing that rescues the convening authority from committing an Article 13 violation. So the convening authority here is trapped, and as a result of the lower court's decision, Navy and Marine Corps convening authorities faced with these facts are similarly going to be trapped because they can't do anything to either avoid an Article 13 violation or violate Article 75A as interpreted by DFAS in the Court of Federal Claims. So it can't be that a convening authority is left with no options. In this case, the convening authority did everything possible to restore the restore appellant and acted in good faith to do what the law required. And in those circumstances, it can't be that we find the convening authority overstepped the bounds of the law.
And none of that has anything to do with whether or not it has a punitive effect or not.
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. But to the extent that that punitive effect or due process needs to be considered with respect to pay entitlement pending rehearing, the venue for that is the Court of Federal Claims, not this court. For the foregoing reasons, the United States asks that this court remand, instructing the lower court to apply Dock and Combs and to clarify whether and to what extent the punitive effect test applies in this context. If there are no further questions, that will conclude my argument.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do we have rebuttal?
Your Honors, the government asks that this court defer to DFAS for interpretations of Article 75A. However, this court is empowered by the UCMJ and by Congress to interpret that portion of the statute. And so what we have here is that Article 75A and the interpretations by DFAS completely go against what we know about what happens with a set-aside. The government continues to violate the law when a lower court or this court sets aside the findings and the sentence and says that the accused does not get to return to his pretrial status. And as this court has recognized in Von Bergen, the point of a rehearing is to place the accused and the government in the same place that they were prior to trial. But if the government's argument continues to go is that they can continue executing the sentence from his first court-martial, then that set-aside has no meaningful effect for the accused. And so we ask that this court interpret Article 75A in the same manner that it did in Keyes, and saying that, you know, it only addresses what was taken away from the accused, and it doesn't address what was going forward. And so this court should interpret 75 and also make sure that the accused is protected whenever there's a set-aside of the findings in the sentence.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Suppose this court does as you say, and they interpret Article 75A to say that the accused should be paid at the rank he was prior to the first court-martial. Would DFAS be obligated to follow the direction of this court? I mean, can we tell DFAS what to do?
Yes, Your Honor. DFAS would be obligated to follow this court's interpretation, because this court is the court that can interpret the statute of the UCMJ.
Right, but in the face of DFAS's claim that they are following this other Article I court over here, why would they then be obligated to follow this Article I court?
Well, this Article I court has a specific jurisdiction to interpret the UCMJ, Your Honor, and that's why it should defer to this court. If were some other matters...
Let's assume I agree with you that they should. He should be paid. But my question is, what authority do we have to make DFAS actually pay him? If DFAS claims it's operating under lawful guidance from the court that it follows, what can we do to make DFAS pay him as an E6?
Well, Your Honor, this court wouldn't be able to tie the hands of DFAS on what it's going to do based on just the interpretation of Article 75, and we would concede that point. But this court can make meaningful relief by providing that interpretation and stating out to DFAS that this is what Article 75 means. DFAS defers to...
So in that instance, then, the service member could take our opinion, walk it over to the Federal Claims Court, and then use it there? Is that what you're saying? Or walk it down to DFAS and say, hey, look, this is what the court said. Are you willing to follow it? And if not, then where would they go? Where would the service member go? Would they then walk over to the Federal Claims Court with our opinion?
Yes, Your Honor. He would still bring it in the Court of Federal Claims for the question of how much pay he's entitled to. The question of whether or not he's been punished, this is a question that this court...
I'm not talking about punishment. I'm simply talking about whether, you know, when DFAS makes the decision and says, hey, we hear you, CAF, but we're not obligated to pay him as an E6 because of what we think the law is. What does the accused do at that point?
He'll have to still bring his claim to the Courts of Federal Claims, Your Honor.
Okay.
I see that my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. The Court thanks Counsel for both parties. The case is now submitted. The Court's going to be in recess. We're going to take a little extra time because we have to rearrange the courtroom a little bit for the next argument. So we'll be in recess until 10:25.
Court stands in recess until 10:25.